Okay, we're back. Okay, so let's settle down after a beautiful fellowship sort of lunch and get back into the business of, you know, saving lives and recovering from deadly disease called alcoholism. So we wanted to just the game plan for the rest of this sessions for today is to get us through talking about, you know, 6, 7 a little bit more, 8, 9, and you know, 10, 11, and hopefully tomorrow we're going to spend most of the morning, if not all of the morning, talking about step 12. So that's the kind of the game plan for the rest of the weekend. But let's see what God has to say about that. So we were talking about 6 and 7, and we were saying that, you know, 6 and 7 is something that it's more of a surrender than anything that we actually do, right? You know, that the prayer is more of an affirmation of an attitude, a mindset, an experience that we have of feeling completely defeated by our alcoholism. Not just alcohol, the bottle, but the ism, the spiritual malady of what's going on here, right? The engine of our disease. You know, and so when we're talking about this, and we're talking about, you know, and Chris made a great point when he was saying, you know, the best way to, you know, the instant character defect removal is amends. But, and I've had sponsees come up to me and they're like, you know, Carrie, what are my character defects? I need to make a list of my character defects. And I'm like, well, you did. It's called a 4-step. You know, I mean, it's a pretty simple thing, you know, we're not making a list and checking it twice and saying, well, you know, I am passive aggressive and I do yada, yada, yada. I mean, a list of my defects of character and what's very clear about what is wrong with Carrie is in the fourth column of my 4-step, in my fear inventory, and in my conduct inventory. You know, so again, you know, I think that people, and I've been guilty of this, is getting stuck in the mechanics of trying to work a perfect step. The idea that if I can just work this perfectly, if I can just find the perfect combination, the perfect, it's not algebra. You know, where there is a right answer and you come out and everything is, you know, X equals 3. When it comes to this stuff, when it comes to the transaction that happens within our spirit in this step process, it is a subtracting process and it's an addition process. Subtracting self, I'm replacing that with God. And it's an experience that we have to have. It's not something that we can think about or figure out. Because when I'm trying to figure out how this step process works, I'm trying to control it. And I can't, in my rational mind, understand the step process. I mean, I have, you know, I'm about 9 credits shy of a master's degree in psychology. I graduated summa. I'm a very intelligent person. Shit, I was an intern at the Museum of Natural History. I got to play with dead things. I mean, when it comes to, you know, academics, you know, like, I'm a freaking star, which is weird because I can't find my car keys and half the time I don't know where I am. But apparently I can read a book and synthesize that information clearly. You know, so when it comes to the step process, I can't use my intellect to try to master this. So this is something we feel in our gut. It's about what happens between us and God. You know, so I can tell you that I've listened to what sounds like completely flawless inventory. I've had people come to me with this most perfectly arrayed 4-step with tabs. And with, like, color-coded things. And their handwriting is impeccable. You know that they rewrote this thing, like, 4 or 5 times so that it's absolutely clear. And it's this most wonderful magnum opus of an inventory. And we get to the 4th column, and I ask them a question. I said, well, can you consider? No. Is it possible? No. Did you? Not even a little. You know, so, I mean, and I'll tell you a quick story. The first time I did a 5-step with a man, and I've done 5-steps with men, I've done 5-steps with women, I've done 5-steps with aliens, okay? The first time it was suggested to me, because I have a long abuse history, a really long one. I experienced a tremendous amount of physical and sexual abuse in my active addiction. So, and prior to, actually. So I had this huge history, and I had a huge resentment with men. I had a huge fear of men, and, like, you guys were evil, and you were pretty much dicks in a wallet, and beyond anything else, I could give a crap. Well, put you all in one state, just, you know, you're there to procreate and provide for me, and I don't give a fuck about how you feel. That was really how I perceived men for a really long time. My marriage was doing really well at that time, I'll tell you that much. But what happened was I could not relate to men in terms of them being a child of God. There was always an adversarial or a desire to control the outcome in any interaction. So it was suggested to me to do a fist step with a man. So I picked like the nicest guy I knew, and I did this fist step, and it was like in the woods, like in this reservation, and I'm all nervous, and I drive up to do this fist step, and I had my four step. I mean, it was like, it looked like it had been pulled out of a cat's ass. It was wrinkled. I couldn't read my own handwriting. Like, it was like this inventory, like I had just been furiously working on, like at points, like I had erased it to like, you know, like there was no paper left. There were holes in it, you know. So I'm sitting in the rain reading this inventory to this guy, you know, and I'm having this profound experience, you know, because it's the first time I'm actually being vulnerable with somebody from the opposite sex. And I have no intention of doing anything other than growing towards God with this person. And I'm trusting them with my life. And it was an incredible experience. Incredible experience. So I had this experience, and I'm looking at this four step. I come home, and it's like the ink is run. There's mud on it. You know, it's a complete and utter travesty. I mean, it's amazing that I was able to get, you know, an A step list off of that damn thing. But that's kind of my point here. You know, like we don't need color-coded binders and action item lists and like, you know, a freaking flow chart for inventory. You know, inventory is about the honesty that I bring to the table and the willingness to have an experience. And so when you bring that kind of spirit to six and seven, it's a 5-minute process that happens after your fifth step, because that's what your quiet hour is for. My quiet hour is to reflect on what I just talked about, what I just shared with God, what I just shared with another human being, what the chunks of truth that I swallowed about myself. How do I really think about my first step? How did I experience my first step? How did I experience my second step? Am I leaving anything out? Do I have common solution, common peril? Do I believe that the 12 steps is an answer to my problem? Or do I believe that my problem to be alcoholism? And my alcoholism is caused by lack of power and not by a bottle. Common peril, common solution. You know, did I really make a decision to continue on with the rest of this process? Did I leave anything out? You take that quiet hour. And I Big Book Gnomes hid that from me for a really long time. You know, I had been writing inventory and fifth-stepping it and then going home and, like, going about my business and never bothered to take that quiet hour until somebody, like, said, oh, I said, we go home for an hour and take the book off the shelf. Oh, shit. I missed that one because the Big Book Gnomes hid it from me. But there's this one thing, and it says, you know, when we're in and we're looking at these prayers, right? On page 76, it says, you know, actually start on 75. And we ask ourselves all these questions, right? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Have we, what does our step process look like up to this point? And then it says, if we can answer these questions to our satisfaction, what questions? Well, the quiet hour. So your six and seven step, or your affirmation of the six and seven step, which you will experience in 10, 11, and 12, by the way, you know, you experience six and seven in making amends and living in 10, 11, and 12. The affirmation of that experience, or that you, this experience that you're going to begin to have, you do after the quiet hour, and it takes 5 minutes. We ask ourselves a couple questions, right? Are we now ready to have God remove all the things we admitted are objectionable? So the thing is when I'm looking over that inventory, I'm sitting in that quiet hour, I'm asking myself, are these things objectionable? And that's what I told you when I was talking about the fifth step. I said, when you're writing your four step and you're doing your fifth step and you're coming into this, if I see somebody skipping into the fifth step with their four step, you know, full of all the dirty deeds that they've done and they're walking in, I'm so happy to write this. I'm like, you're a fucking liar. Really? Like, you wrote down all this stuff and you feel wonderful? Truly? What'd you miss? What'd you lie about? What'd you rationalize? Because, you know, writing down these things, we're not supposed to feel good. We're supposed to admit they're objectionable. That means that there are things about ourselves we don't like. We're supposed to have an experience of not liking things about ourselves. So again, if you wrote a four step and you're coming into a fifth step and you got this four step and you're just like, la 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 la. I'm like, somebody didn't look deep enough. So let's go deeper. I don't literally tell them I'm a liar. What I do is I start asking questions, and all of a sudden they start crying, and then all of a sudden we have a God experience. That's kind of how that works. and says, can he take them now, everyone? And that doesn't say, will he? He says, can he? So here's the thing I really want you to think about is the higher power that you believe in at this moment big enough to take all the things that you find objectionable about yourself? Or are you limiting God? You know, is it, well, he can have, you know, my drinking problem, but he can't have my financial problems. He can have my financial problems, but he can't have my marriage. Or I'm, you know what? I've been a bonehead in recovery. I've done incredibly stupid things. Please ask my friends, dude, you know? So the idea here is that I'm not perfect. Never have claimed to be perfect. I'm not a saint. I fall short all the time. Am I hiding that? Am I pretending to be something that I'm not? Am I playing the guru when in reality I'm the sinner? So here's that question. Is my God big enough for me to be humble and human and not have to hide behind a screen of perfectionism or sainthood, or I'm the Allah, the Buddha, and all these things, and I walk on water, and meanwhile, like, you know, I'm kicking the dog and beating the kids and yelling and screaming and stomping my feet? You know, what do we call that? The AA, what, the real, the AA angel and the real world devil? You know? So there's the question, is my God big enough for that? Or do I need to have a deeper, more meaningful experience with God? If your higher power, if your, the God you're thinking about at this moment isn't big enough to fix you, it's not God's limits. It's the limits of your own concept that you're placing on God. God is infinite and can do all of these things. The only thing that limits God is my willingness to allow God to do his job. If we cling to something, we will not let it go. We ask God to help us to be willing. And here's this coolest thing, because like, how many times have you guys sat in a meeting and heard somebody say that they've been on steps 6 and 7 for like 5 years? Guess what? You're not even on 6 and 7. You're on step 0. Because, you know, it says we ask them to remove them. So if there's something we're stuck on, we ask them to keep to remove them, and we keep going. Exactly. So then we make this, and then of course we say this prayer, this affirmation. And of course this prayer is the bookend to the third step prayer. The third step prayer doesn't have an amen for a reason. We make an affirmation. We ask God for a deal. We say, I'm broken. I can't fix myself. I'm willing to be a part of your creation. Please fix me so that I can be of service to you and my fellows. I do some work. I see the things that are not working, the things that are not good in my inventory, right? The things that are unsaleable goods. I have an experience with that. I share the state of the unsaleable goods in my inventory with God and another human being. Because when we fifth step, it says with God and another human being. Understanding that if God is everywhere and we're children of God and God is within us and God is within me and God's within you, when we're sitting having a fifth step, God is present in all of this. There's no place where God is not. So I have this experience and I come to this, and then I'm saying another aspect of this prayer. It's the same prayer, but just in a little bit different a form. And of course, we talked about the my creator and stop creating myself. And it goes on to say that we ask God to remove every single defect of character, right? Which stands in the usefulness of to you and my fellows. I ask that God should have all of me, good and bad. I don't decide what God gets. I just ask God to remove what he sees fit. I don't get to decide that. And then what do I do with that? I keep going. We don't stop. We don't work on our character defects. If I had the power to work on my character defects, I wouldn't need to come here, man. I can find something better to do with my time. I like you all, but really? You know, sitting around reading this book, talking about God, I could be like, you know, out like, you know, clubbing or like power surfing or some shit. But I'm here in a church basement because I don't have the power to do that. You know, my book tells me that I'm as powerless over my selfishness as I am over my alcoholism or over whether or not I drink. Excuse me. So I'm as powerless over my fear, because we have a fear prayer. It says, you know, we ask God to remove this fear and direct us to have what he would have us be, right? So the idea is that if I could conquer fear, I wouldn't need to ask God to remove it, wouldn't I? So if I'm asking God to remove my fear and direct my attention, then quite obviously I can't remove my own fears, right? I can't remove my selfishness. I can't remove my self-centeredness. I can't remove my resentments. I can't remove my fears. And I can't think my way through the drink. That is the state of carry without power. So then I go to that power and I say, all right, let's go. So what do? Well, we had this 4-step, right? Yeah, I love it when people talk about burning the 4-step. It's a cleansing exercise. And I don't know about you, but my book said that is the key, right? It says it's the key to my life, right? We go back to our 4-step because it holds the key. So I'm going to burn the thing that I need to be able to complete the rest of this process. Sounds crazy to me, you know. So we take our 4-step and we go on. I was taught, and this was just me, I was taught to take every single name off of that list and make a card. And when I do my sex inventory or my harms or my conduct inventory, I don't just include the person I had the relationship with. I also do something called the tornado exercise. So, like, say my husband, right? He's been on my sex and harms inventory more times than I can count. When I write about that relationship, I write about him. And then I look at the people around our relationship that were affected by my actions, my behavior, my thoughts, things like that. So I'm including, you know, my children, maybe his mother, my parents, friends of ours, when I'm writing that inventory. Because what I'm doing is I'm looking at not just the relationship with that person, but all the fallout peripheral relationships that were affected by that relationship. So when I do that in my sex inventory, then I have people to put on my harms inventory. You get what I'm saying? And that's why it's a progression. We have resentment. We have fear. We have sex. And we have harms. So when I'm doing my sex inventory and I'm adding ancillary people who are related to that specific relationship, I take them off of that because it says, who did we hurt? I didn't just hurt the person I was in the relationship with. I hurt other people who were around. And take those names and I put them in a harms inventory, which asks the same questions. Who did I hurt? You know, did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? You know? Where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, inconsiderate, and frightened? What could I have done instead? So I have this list. I have a list of people that I resented. I have people that I harmed that I didn't resent. I have a list of people that I was in relationships with that I might have harmed. And I start making that list. First, very simple thing, I get a blank piece of paper. I start making that list right off my 4-step. Then I can transfer them to cards. Now, not everybody on your A-step list are you going to go knocking on their door. I mean, that's where sponsorship's incredibly important, why sponsorship is not what we're doing right now. What we're doing right now is called the 12th step in terms of we are using attraction rather than promotion to present some concepts and ideas and get you excited about this process, to maybe give you some things to chew on, to think about, to bring back to the people that you're sponsored by or people that you're sponsoring, and you're in your fellowship, in your community, and you're going to have an experience with that. You know, being sponsored in terms of a seminar, being sponsored in terms of tapes and things like that, this is where, like, having somebody and accountability and guidance is incredibly important. Because I don't know how many times I have there's a funny story. My husband had a sponsee many, many, many years ago. He went to go make amends to his ex-girlfriend and ended up getting a blowjob. No lie. You know. And my husband was like, well, why didn't you ask me before you went to go make that amends? He was like, because you would have told me not to do it. I was like, now you got to make amends for that. Later. You know. So that's why, like, just because I think I need to make that amends and I decided what the amend is and I decided what the harm is doesn't mean that's really what I should be doing. This is where counsel and good sponsorship is incredibly important, because what we don't want to do is cause more harm when we're going out to clean up the harm that we caused. You know, and there's an Oxford group saying, it says the light of God shines brighter through two windows than one. And that is a true statement. So the idea is, I don't know how many times I've had a sponsee call me up and they're like, dude, I have this amends. And I'm like, I have no idea. Like, seriously, I have no idea how you're going to make an amends for that. But, like, you know what? Give me a few minutes. Let me go pray. Let me ask God. Let me make some phone calls and I'll get back to you. And like, you know, and inevitably I'll be like praying, okay, God, I don't even know where to go with that one. Like, I have no experience with that. And then I'll be like, oh, so-and-so does. That's right. Boom. Call them up. Boom. And so there's this awesome thing is like, one of the things that I do as a sponsor is I kind of make note of people and their amends experiences and their 12-step experiences, so that if I don't have an answer for somebody, because, you know, being a sponsor doesn't mean always having an answer. It means a willingness to assist somebody to get and establish and maintain a relationship with their higher power. So if I don't have the answer, that's okay. It is perfectly okay to say, I don't know. I do not know how many times I've literally looked at a sponsee in the face and been like, dude, you got me. I have no idea on that one. I'm stumped. Let's figure this out. Let's pray. You know, let's say a little prayer. Let's figure this out. And it's amazing how that vital sixth sense really begins to flow and we can access it. You know, so for me, in my experience, you know, I make that list. I'm not knocking on that door yet. What I'm doing is I'm making a list of the people that I harmed. And then I have to think, and that's where we go back into meditation. We go back and we say, well, what were the harms? You know, I'm so egotistical that, like, I'll think I harmed you because I thought at you. Because I'm so fucking important. That what I think in my head while I'm looking at you, but I've never said a word and we've never met, harmed you. You know, because, you know, I'm omnipotent and everything like that. And you know what I'm thinking and, you know. So, I mean, like, so my sponsor had to sit down with me and she was like, you know, so what are the actual harms? Well, I didn't like her. What'd you do? Nothing. Were you ever mean to her? No. Did you do anything? No. So what was the harm? I didn't like her. And it's like, well, Carrie, is that really a harm? Or are you just trying to prove how spiritually you are by going to make amends to every single person you ever met ever in your life so you can show how humble you are? Oh, good point. So what we need to do is be very clear on the harms that we've caused. I don't know how many times I've gone into an amends where I thought my harm was one thing and it turned out to be something entirely different. Because here's something amazing is other people other than me are having a completely different experience with me than I think they are. Because I'm selfish and self-centered and I can't see beyond the tip of my nose. So I only experience you through me, my filter, and I can only the assumptions that I make about how you all think is based on my experience, because I can only use my experience to experience you. Does that make sense to you? So, like, you know, when you think somebody's doing something and that's, you attribute all these terrible, terrible things to that look where she might have farted or something and you think she's thinking you're a bitch and you're fat and you're this, that, and the other thing, you're thinking all this stuff and you realize that that person's probably not thinking any of those things, but you think like that? That hypocrisy? Because there's that wonderful question, you know, like, and again, the four steps are a beautiful thing because there's this, that wonderful question, where am I dishonest? Well, I do the same stuff that I judge other people for all the time. I stand in judgment. I'm an absolute and total hypocrite. God forbid you don't like me, but I don't like you. But you have to like me because, what, I need you to like me. But I cannot like you all I want. But you have to like me. How insane is that? So when we sit down and we do this A step, what we really want to do is be clear on the harms. And mind you, this is another thing where you're not writing your A step for 9 months. This is a 10-minute process. Let me give you a quick time frame. Okay. You write your 4-step. Typically with the women that I sponsor, if you're a newcomer, and I mean newcomer, I mean like you're still shake, rattle, and rolling, and like, you know, like maybe you got 2 weeks. If that, typically, I get you, I snag you in a meeting, you have no idea what you're doing, and I just grab you and say, come to my house, we're going to read the big book. I'm going to read the big book. We go through steps 1, 2, and 3 in about an hour. I hand you a pen and a notebook, and I start making a list of people you're pissed off at. Come back to me in a couple days when you're done with that list. So you come back. Okay. Why are you mad? Write that down. Let's do that together. Boom. How'd they affect you? Boom. What's your part? Boom. What are you afraid of? Boom. Their inventory is done in a matter of a couple days to a couple weeks, depending on how fast they write it. So they come back, and as we're doing this, we're actually fist stepping. as I'm going through and they're writing inventory and I'm giving them direction, I'm giving them the next thing to do, we're going through what they're doing. So their fifth step, we sit down with their finished inventory and we might have a 2-hour, 3-hour conversation because we've been fifth stepping as they're writing it. Because I'm a liar and I'm a dope fiend. And so I don't know how many times I've written inventory and I've skimped and I've this and I've that. And my sponsor had to go back and say, can you consider? Why don't you write this down? Can you consider? Blah, blah, blah. So I find that it really helpful to sit down with them as they're writing it because I help pull things out of them. So it's a more efficient process. Because I'll ask them questions like, oh, I totally did that out of resentment too. I'm going to go back and fix that. So they're doing that, right? They do their fifth step. They take their quiet hour. They say their 6- and 7-step prayer. They make an 8-step list. They start making amends the next day. So from step 1 to step 9 could be anywhere from a weekend to a day, depending, to a matter of 3 weeks. Between step 1 and step 9. I'm not talking about a really long time frame. We're not writing Moby Dick. There's no magnum opus, you know, Kinko's version of a 4-step. We're getting through some inventory, we're getting to some truth, and we're getting on amends. And we're doing that in a very, very efficient process. Now, if you have time and you've been through the steps a few million times, of course, I'm going to have you do some extra special dandy stuff with your inventory just to smash your ego a little bit extra, like my sponsors did for me. And we're going to have a different process with that. But what I'm telling you is the time frame from the 5th step to the 9th step is about an hour and 20 minutes, a quiet hour, a prayer, and a list-making process. Do you have anything you want to add?
You know, when you look at this process, the way the big book lays it out, there's an economy to this work. We will find ways to complicate it. We'll find ways to elongate the steps and add stuff to it. And, you know, especially some of the step working guides that you can find out there, they'll have you writing forever. With the book Alcoholics Anonymous, there's an economy. There's a story in the back. I forget the name of it, but it's an individual who went through the steps with Dr. Bob. And he says, Dr. Bob had me over to his house on a free weekend. And then it talks about how he took him basically through most of the steps in a very, very short period of time. I believe in the earlier days, this was a very, very quick process. And, you know, we've done things to it at worst. Things like there's some groups in my area where you still hear you do a step a year. That's the worst that you'll hear. But even in just most groups and most sponsorship, you're going to find people who are going to going to want to slow the process down. And sometimes that makes a lot of sense because you want to be thorough, you want to be fearless, and you want to be thorough. But when you look at the work in here, the work is going to take. You know, up to step 9, the work is going to take about 4 to 6 hours and however long you procrastinate. Yep. So it could take a week and 4 to 6 hours, a month and 4 to 6 hours, or 5 years and 4 to 6 hours. You know, it depends on, you know, how much you want to procrastinate with it. Now, there's a spiritual appendix at the back of this book where it talks about the spiritual experience. And it says, you know, some of us have had spiritual experiences of the educational variety slowly over the course of time. Because by the time that appendix was put in, people were slowly over the course of time going through the steps. They weren't pushing through with the rapidity that was known in the earlier years. You go through really fast, you're going to have a sudden and profound spiritual awakening. You go through slow, you're going to have one of the educational variety. I had one of the educational variety because I just didn't know. I mean, how do you know what you don't know? I was landing in groups where people really thought that they were addressing the steps because they were going to step meetings and sharing about the steps. They really thought, oh yeah, I'm doing the steps. I go to 2 step meetings a week. Yeah, that's like the opposite of doing the steps, going to step meetings. You'll learn how to share about the steps, how to philosophize about the steps, how to listen to people talk about the steps. You can read the steps, but rarely do you find people in those meetings who actually do them. You know, so that's probably the worst place that you can go if you want to go through the steps. But I didn't know any of this. You know, I didn't know any of this until I was exposed to some tapes. You know, that's why I'm a huge supporter of the people who with the recorded message. I would be dead if it wasn't for the recorded message, because the meetings that I was going to in the early days, they were not about, you know, working the steps. They were not about using the big book. The big books weren't even sold in the meetings I was going to. You know, maybe the step book, but mostly, you know, the Hazleton stuff was being sold. You know, this is the very early 90s where, you know, it was all self-help books and Wounded Inner Children and all this other stuff was going on. So, you know, there was a lot of that stuff happening, but there was, you know, the big book was looked at like, oh my God, that was written in the 30s. You know, they knew only a little. Well, let me tell you, they knew a whole lot. I don't think any literature has really improved the recovery experience since this book. There's tons of new literature coming out of every 12-step fellowship in the world, and some of it's very, very good. But I think a lot of times it confuses the actual process that's in this book. The 12 and 12 certainly confuses things. The process in this book has a certain economy. And when you address this like it's a textbook, like you're going through it, you know, and you're doing the exercises, if you approach it like that, you're going to have an experience. Think about this. Like, you know, my early experience in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it would have been like this. Let's say you want to get the calculus experience, okay? I mean, someone has told you that if you get a full knowledge and experience of calculus, you're going to be able to do your job better. And you start going to a calculus classroom, and you don't open the textbook. All you really want to do is raise your hand and share, you know, during the calculus class. And you want to go out to maybe the diner afterward with some of the people who are in the calculus classroom. And you do everything hanging out with and fellowshipping with the calculus people in that particular class. But you never open the textbook. You never learn how to solve the problems. Wouldn't that be insane? But that's what we were doing in the late 80s and early 90s in Alcoholics Anonymous. We were sharing in the classroom, not opening the book, not learning how to solve the problem, not learning about recovery. And this was a widespread experience. You know, there's always been pockets of enthusiasm, places where they were about the business of recovery, you know, in different places in the country, certainly Denver, you know, some places down south, Texas. There was a guy in Chicago that was promoting the actual practice of the big book as a recovery experience for 50 years, you know. Or 60 years. We just lost him not too long ago. So there's been places where this has been happening, but the easier, softer way is to go in and share. I don't know about all this homework. I just want to share. I mean, listen, that's what we want to do. Sometimes, though, it's not about what you want to do if you want to have this recovery experience. You know, Carrie started to move into step 8 and a little bit of step 9. You want to put horsepower in your recovery. These are the steps. Step 9 especially. My experience with step 9 was I came out of step 9 with so much power it was ridiculous. I could barely get out of my own way, and I felt uncomfortable going into a grocery store before step 9. I was always looking over my shoulder, and I was always worried about the past catching up with me. I could not live in the moment. In Bill's meditation this morning, there was so much emphasis on being in the moment, living right now. And if you haven't done your amends, it's going to be near impossible to live in the now, because the past is always going to be catching up with you, or you're always going to be worrying that the past is going to be catching up with you. So, you know, I basically started to approach step nine. I started to do some of the easier steps, some of the ones that I was willing to do. And it started to gain momentum. I started to feel the change. You know, the spiritual experience of this particular step started to come over me. And I got excited about this step. And I did a lot of amends. There's some that it took multiple inventories to figure out. There was some stuff that I guess I wasn't ready to see in some of my earlier eight-step lists. But over the course of time, there's been a lot of things that have revealed themselves to me. You know, in this book, it talks about practically every kind of amends you can make. The man that we hated, all right, that's one. Most alcoholics owe money. This is page 76 through about page 80. Perhaps we've committed criminal offenses. It gives us some instructions about that. Other people may be involved, and they give us some instructions where other people are involved. Domestic troubles. You know, we might have stepped out on the missus. Can you imagine? You know, or we may be in the middle of, listen, most of us, when we come up out of the bomb shelter, you know, to take an assessment of our lives, we're not doing very well with our marriage or with our relationships. You know, they're usually on the last straw, if anything. And so it gives us information on that. It talks about our design for living is not a one-way street. It talks about how we can engage the family if the family is willing and ready to move along the spiritual lines with us. That's a good thing. That's not always the way it is, but it talks about what we can do to help make that happen. It talks about us being the tornado roaring our way through the lives of others. Most of the time, we are going to minimize. Remember, alcoholism is an illness of minimization. We're going to minimize. The first thing that'll happen, you know, when you're looking at an eight-step list for the first time with a sponsee, is they're going to minimize. They're only going to be able to see so much. You know, a lot of times it's our job to help them dig into this. You know, and it's also important if we're sponsors, if we're working with people, it's also important not to edit somebody's eight-step list. Okay, the eight-step list should be complete. We can counsel during the ninth step when they're going out and making amends. So, you know, some amends, you know, you need to tact, common sense. You need to act rationally. You need to be sure other people aren't getting involved. You need to know that the person is going to be ready to see you. There's a lot of things that happen in step nine, but in step eight, it's important to be as thorough as possible. One of the things that was happening around my area early on, and this was the step meeting culture that I came out of in the early 90s, was people would share about something that was really bothering them, and other people would share right behind them and cut them the slack. In other words, you know, somebody would say, you know, I really feel terrible. You know, I have two divorces, I lost a bunch of jobs. And then somebody will come behind him and say, you know, the best thing you can do is to just not do that stuff anymore or whatever. And what they're doing is, you know, we're worried about how people think about us, you know, whether they're going to like us or not. And what we're doing is we're cutting people slack. We're interfering with their own personal spiritual experience. That should be a sin in recovery, you know, to rob somebody of a vital spiritual experience, something like going through your eight-step list and actually making direct amends to the people in the institutions who you've harmed, and doing the best you can with that and getting as complete as possible with the list. That is an unbelievable experience. I know what it feels like to be prior to finishing my amends, and I know how I feel after addressing every single amends on my list in the best possible way. I know the difference in those two spiritual states of mind. And they really are the difference between night and day. They really are. And for some of us, for the real alcoholics and the real drug addicts, it can be the difference between life and death, whether we do this or not. I have seen people refuse to make certain amends, and they did everything else. But they refused to go back to the IRS. You know, they hadn't been paying taxes in 25 years. They just couldn't imagine, you know, what that's going to look like. So they conveniently figured they didn't need to do that one. And they've been relapsing like clockwork for the last 15 years. And they wonder why. You know, so I think our spiritual condition, and sometimes our lives, are directly proportional to, you know, how we address this ninth step. Just a few of my experiences. You know, when I came up out of the storm cellar, you know, wondering if the tornado had blown by yet, Ma. You know, I had done a lot of damage. Certainly family damage. Certainly with employers. And I started to go back, and I certainly made amends to all my direct family, made amends to my ex-bosses, you know, made amends to the friends that I had really let down, made amends to the people I had owed money, made amends to the institutions where I'd shoplifted or stolen. You know, I did all those types of amends. And I think a few of them were really, really remarkable. One of them was, I went back to my last boss, and this was the boss that I spent my last 2 years of drinking working for. I can't even tell you I was a bad electrician for this guy, and the things that I did. He liked me, so, and he was a big drinker himself, so he didn't have the heart to fire me. But some of the trouble I caused this guy, it was unbelievable. So I'm out of rehab about 6 months. I'm making the phone calls. And I called him up, and I'm trying to get a chance to go into his office to see him. He goes, I don't want to see you. About 2 or 3 months after that, I go to his office to see him without making a phone call. And he's like, get out of here. I don't got time to hear. Just get out of here. I don't want to hear it. And so I'm all right. I'm almost at the point where this is water over the dam. I've done my best, you know, the way it says in the book. But I'm going to get a haircut this one time, and I walk into the barbershop, and he's sitting right over there in the corner. So I got him trapped. So I go over and I say, hey, how you doing, Frank? You know, and I start talking. And I sat there. So for about 10 minutes while we're waiting to get our haircut, I was able to cover the deal. I was able to cover the deal with him. And it was only a few months after that that we started to do business together. I mean, I never worked for him again, but he actually worked for me. I was hiring him for different jobs because I was a facility manager by that time. That was a good experience. Another experience was I would get really drunk at family events, and there was a niece. And this niece reminded me so much of me that I would just get unbelievably resentful at her. You know, she just bothered me. She was irresponsible and irreverent and, you know, all the things that, you know, I hated about myself. So I would get drunk out of my mind. And I would say things to her that an uncle just should not be saying to like a 19-year-old niece. Okay. Just really nasty stuff. And so I'm sober. I know I've got to make this amends. I set it up. I talk to her. I basically lay out the deal. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not going to ever be able to get over this unless I do my best to set right the wrongs. I've caused you some harm. I'm going to share with you the harm that I'm clear on, you know, and I ask the questions. I get through this whole thing, and she is shocked. She's like, wow. You know, she's like, I've never experienced anything like this before in my life. Thank you. You know, and that was about all the feedback I got from her. Well, about 3 months later, she had some psychological stuff going on. 3 months later, when she was in a mental hospital after a suicide attempt, guess who she felt comfortable calling for help? Me, because of what I shared with her about my own alcoholism and my own challenges. Before she called her mother and her father, she called me. And here's what I was able to do. I was able to point her toward professional help. She obviously needed counseling and all this stuff. And when I started to talk to her about counseling, she goes, "Oh, my father used to threaten me." I go, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "He used to say all the time, if we don't behave, he's going to take us to the head shrinkers." Like, so she's like, "I don't want to go anywhere near them." And I'm like, "Oh, don't listen to him. Oh my God. You know, therapists are great for people like you. You know, my wife's been going for 18 years. You know," I said to her, you got to get yourself a therapist. So this was like 15, 20 years ago. And she's been in therapy, and her life is just never again was there a bad problem, like a life threatening problem. And, you know, she's still a bit dysfunctional and everything, but I'll tell you what, in a healthy way, you know, she's not out there causing any harm. She's living life the way she wants to live it. You know, I could go on and on and on, and I'm sure Carrie's got a bunch of experiences of her own, but 9 times out of 10, even when I got thrown out of the office, mm-hmm. not 10 times out of 10, these things ended up being a positive experience for me. Here's what will happen, though. Your ego will try to scare you out of these. Your ego will say, "Oh, my God, I can't do that. He'll call the police. Or I'll get beat up. Or they'll shame me and make me feel small." Or whatever kind of defenses your ego is going to want to put up to keep you from experiencing this unbelievably powerful step. Step 9, you want power in your life? You want to be able to step out and go do? This is the step that will give you that power.
Yeah, I do have a couple of amends stories. And that's one of the things that, you know, I think it's important to share that. I mean, because we all talk, you know, inventory stories are fun, but it's the amends stories that I think that are the, how can I explain it? There's magic in amends. There's something about that healing. There's something about one, facing yourself, facing the things that you've done, being willing to set it right, facing them, the other human being, giving them the opportunity to talk to you, giving them, validating their experience. You know, because I'm a consummate liar, and like, unless you had me on videotape, I didn't do it. You know, so people began to doubt the reality around me because I was always lying. I work in treatment now, and I'll have a positive, you know, urine test, and I'll be like, "There seems to be oxycodone in your urine. What? I just don't know how that got in there." Really? You know, did the oxy fairies put it in your pee?
Oxy fairies.
You know, and I'm just watching them because I did the exact same thing. Like, "I have no idea who took your credit card, Mom, and charged a bunch of concert tickets and then scalped them for money for drugs. I have no idea who would do that." Yeah. So, really, I did do that too. I was slick. My parent, like my mother, like showered with her purse after, you know, after a couple of those incidents. But the idea is that, you know, people began to doubt their reality. So part of, you know, yes, it's, you know, that sense of going back out into the world, you know, the steps, you know, 1, 2, and 3 are about me, alcohol, and God. Steps 4 and 5 are about me and God. You know, 6 and 7 are about me and God. 8 and 9 are about me, God, and you. You know, and 10, 11, and 12 are about, you know, maintaining that spiritual experience and maintaining those lines of communication, so that I can be more about me, God, and you. You know, so when we're talking about, you know, knowing where I fell short, knowing what my character defects are, knowing what my harms are, and being willing to face the world with them are two very different things. You know, and, you know, I have a couple of amends stories. Chris talked about having the right inventory a handful of times to get, you know, the full, you know, knowledge and experience with my harms. I mean, my parents, they were wonderful people. Like, my parents are not alcoholics. I'm one of 5 kids. 4 of us have darkened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. So they had, like, demon spawn. But, like, my parents are, like, upstanding members of community, and they don't drink. They don't do anything. They're just, like, wonderful human beings, and their children were possessed by demons. So, you know, they really didn't know what to do with us. And, you know, and so when they made a lot of mistakes because they just didn't know. Like, what do you do with a bunch of junkies and drunks tearing up your house? So I'm the youngest, so I kind of got the brunt of everything, and I had a lot of resentments. I had a lot of resentments with, like, with my brother, and there was a lot of violence in my household. My parents were old school, so they were, like, my dad thought nothing of, like, you know, choking me if he caught me with a beer, you know, things like that. So things that are, like, border on child abuse, but, you know, border. But I had a lot of these things going on in my household and a lot of resentments and a lot of stuff with that. So when I wrote inventory, you know, on my mom, who never really did any of this stuff for me, but I blamed for my life and the things that I experienced because I felt like she should have protected me or saved me from the things that had happened. I mean, between my two older brothers who beat the living hell out of me and you know, being molested for, you know, 7 years, I kind of felt like my parents had sort of, like, missed some shit in my childhood. And I had a lot of resentments. I didn't blame them really for my drinking, but I still blame them for me being messed up. And I wrote inventory again and again on my mother, and I could not get to that place. I just could not see that I was stuck. So every time I would make an amends to her, it was like it never, like, you know, it was almost like the key never really fit the lock. So it would stick in the hole, but when I would turn it, the door would not open. And I just kept trying at it, and I kept doing inventory, and I kept doing this. And I had this sponsor who had a daughter my age, and she was an active alcoholic when her daughter was, you know, younger, and she's sober, and blah, 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 blah. And her daughter's sober, and her daughter's a good friend of mine. And I'm reading this inventory on my mom to her, and, you know, she stops, and she looks at me, and she goes, who are you to decide your mother didn't love you? Because that was my beef. You didn't love me. You didn't protect me. You didn't protect me from my older brother. You didn't protect me from the child molester. You didn't protect me from the violence in the household. You didn't protect me from the flying chairs and all the things that happened. So therefore, you didn't love me. And she, you know, this woman who had the experience of being an alcoholic mother and the experience of making amends to her daughter was listening to the inventory of a, you know, somebody who had a very similar experience to her daughter. She got to hear it with my mother's ears. And as I'm reading this inventory, she starts asking me questions. She's like, well, how do you know? She's like, I want you to take a look at that situation. And she's like, okay, when your brother threw you down the flight of stairs when you were 8, what was going on there? And I was like, well, my mother was at work and my dad was at work. And, you know, she didn't know. And she's like, well, can you blame her for something she didn't know? No. She's like, what would have happened if she threw your brother out of the house? I said, well, my brother was a heroin addict. It was likely that he would die. She's like, so you would rat, you know, you're mad at her for not protecting you. You wanted her to throw your brother out of the house so that she can prove that she loves you by watching her son die. Whoa. I am really selfish. But I saw myself as being a victim. I was a victim. You know, these terrible things happened to me, and they did. Totally. Like, I was in therapy for a really long time over this stuff. You know, so they were real things. It was a real trauma. But I was so selfish. I wanted her to prove that she loved me. I wanted her to prove. And I decided how she was supposed to prove that. I made a pre-designated concept. And when she didn't do it, when she didn't live up to it, I judged her. And then I rejected her. And every time I looked at her, I looked at her with the eyes of somebody who says, you're not good enough because you didn't do a good enough job raising me. And can you imagine looking into your daughter's eyes who just looks at you saying that you failed me? How horrible that must feel. So when my sponsor pointed out, well, part of the reason why you're constantly butting heads with your mother is because you're constantly bringing these demands to her. You're not a child. You're a grown woman. You're 22 years old. Why are you looking to your mother to be your mother when you're a grown woman and you're a mother yourself? Why do you need this? What is within you that you need her to be this way with you? And I was like, holy shit. I had no idea. I couldn't figure it out. So finally, I had this profound experience in this inventory, and I went and I made amends to my mom. And the one thing I had always wanted was for her just to acknowledge that this stuff had gone on in my childhood. Because one of the things that, you know, the great Al-Anons do, no offense to the Al-Anons, was it didn't happen. Don't tell the neighbors. As long as you have white, you know, if you have lace curtains, we call it the lace curtain Irish, which means that you can beat the shit out of each other on the inside and everybody comes out with the spit, you know, the collar and the, you know, everybody's spit shined and everything's good. And meanwhile, the walls inside the house are splattered with blood. You know, christenings on our house where, you know, people tumbling out the back, fighting on the lawn. And like, literally, they would pull the cars around the house to, like, you know, so people couldn't see in the backyard. You know, and this is, like, in Bloomfield and Montclair, New Jersey. So, it's, you know, we're not talking trailer parks. We're talking, like, you know, middle-class, upper-middle-class towns. And, like, you know, my brother's beating the crap out of my father in the back lawn. And everybody's going, shh, don't tell the neighbors. So there was that secret. Like, carry our secret. Pretend. Pretend that this isn't happening. Just carry our secret. And I was very angry about that, but I realized that by demanding that she give in, that her reality match my reality, I was continuing to harm her. So at 5 years sober, I sat down to make an amends to her, and I made amends for, you know, the harms that I caused her. And she burst into tears, and she said, you know, you didn't have it easy. She's like, I've made a ton of mistakes in your life, and I'm so sorry. And she starts crying. All I had to do was stop demanding from her and judging her. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't say anything. It was my body language. You know, when you're talking to somebody, you know when they don't like you. And my poor mother, who had raised me, had given me her lifeblood. I mean, shit, they used to call me the tumor because they thought I was cancer. My parents gave birth to me when they were in their 40s. So, like, they told my mother that she had cancer and that she was going to die. And they went to go remove the tumor, and it turned out to be me. So this poor woman, this is her life. Like, I'm the bane of her. That's really true. That's the bane. My brother used to call me the tumor. So this is this poor woman, you know. She raises a bunch of demon seed children, or, you know, drunken brawls in the front lawn. She's told that she has cancer, turns out to be another child. You know, like, all of this stuff is going on. She's stretched to the edge, and I'm sitting there at 22 years old going, you're a failure as a mother. Because you didn't love me right. And I refuse to forgive you until you accept that you fucked up. So, by that one little thing, letting go of that one mental demand, boom. I've had two times where I've actually raised my voice to my mother in the past 14 years. One time when I was pregnant. You know? I mean, it doesn't happen. I don't react to her anymore. I just don't. Because I don't have that in me anymore. It was gone. It was healed. It was done. Boom. And it took a handful of inventories, a handful of amends. It took a bit to get to that truth because I didn't know what it was that I wouldn't forgive. And it wasn't until I came to that truth that I was able to do that. But some simple amends. I mean, like the paying back the stores thing. That's a great one. It's a great exercise. I was a kleptomaniac thief. And, like, I was an underage alcoholic, so there are only a couple ways that, you know, I got booze on a regular basis, one of which was NyQuil. So I had this habit of, like, you know, going into drugstores and cleaning them out of all their NyQuil. In fact, I just met a girl. I was one of the few people, like, because, like, you know, like, again, you know, underage alcoholics never had it legal. People are, like, we had to be really inventive about how we got, you know, got our booze. You know, so it was NyQuil and Sudafed, you know. And we would, like, it was this, it's the junkie kid cocktail, right? So we would, you know, we'd shove them in our backpacks and we would steal, right? So I had to go back to all these pharmacies, all these supermarkets and whippets. That was the other one, stealing whipped cream. Walking down the aisles doing whippets. Like these, like, degenerate kids wandering through ShopRite, like, throwing whipped cream cans, you know, in the aisles at 2 o'clock in the morning. Stuff like that. So I had to go back to all these stores and pay back the money. And it was an amazing thing. And these are stores I shopped in. This is a town that I grew up in. You know, this is where I got sober. These are people that I saw every day of my life. And there was something about going in and making amends for these things, paying back that money, and being able to just walk out and be like, I can do anything. I can face any amend I have to make. And there have been a lot of amends in recovery that have been amazing. I mean, not just things about things that I did when I was drinking, but things that I've done in sobriety. You know, I mean, I see the truth about my behaviors, my thoughts, my, you know, all the time. And I have to go back and say, gee, you know, what I did wasn't so great. I'm really sorry. You know, what can I do to set that right? You know, and a profound amend that I made was, and I shared about it earlier or yesterday, was to my high school principal. It doesn't sound like a big deal. I mean, I was a fire starter. I got kicked out of a bunch of schools and I destroyed a lot of property. So not only did I have to pay back my parents for all the, you know, things that they had to pay, like fines and stuff, You know, they had to pay for, you know, and the money I stole, and the jewelry I stole, and the drugs I stole, and the medications I stole, and all the, you know, credit card fraud, check kiting, and all those other things that I did. I did all of that. You know, and then I, you know, like the brat that I was, but you didn't raise me right, but, you know, I literally committed check fraud. My parents, God bless them. You know, God bless them. But so I had to go back and make amends because my sponsor was an educator. And she was like, so like, what were you like in the classroom? I'm like, well, I set some fires sometimes. What? Just Bunsen burners. What? She's like, what else did you do? Well, you know, I told, you know, educators to fuck off. Really? So you cursed at your elders? Yes. You broke school property? You destroyed school property? Yes. You disabled smoke alarms? Yes. What else did you do? You know, and it was like, oh, there's a long list of harms. You know, like when we talk about conduct inventory, we're talking conduct inventory. So when I'm reading that conduct, she's like, damn. She's like, that's a lot of money. I'm like, yeah, that's a lot of money I have to pay back. She's like, that deserves a visit. Shit. So I had to write a letter of amend to the faculty. And of course, I had been thrown out of 5 schools. So there was 5 different visits I had to make. But one of them, which was very significant, which is my oldest sister, who is not an addict or an alcoholic. She's a wonderful human being, and I don't know how she actually is related to me. She was like the perfect one. She's 16 years older than me. Everybody thought I was her illegitimate child because we look alike, and she was 16 when I was born. So I think people assumed that maybe she like might even went away for a weekend, you know, for a summer and came back with a daughter and passed her off. But I really am my mother's daughter. But the rumors in the neighborhood were that I was really my sister's daughter, which is kind of funny. So I'm the tumor, and I'm my sister's illegitimate child. I don't know which one yet. Anyway, so my sister was really, really intelligent and very sweet and just a very nice person. And she had this homeroom teacher. His name was Mr. Orsini. And the day that I was born, she came into the classroom and she was like, you know, I have a baby sister. And she was so happy because she named me. She named me Carrie. Her name is Maureen. We're not Irish at all. Last name Cosgrove. Forget it. You know. So she came in, she told them all about this beautiful baby sister. And of course I had the black hair and the green eyes. So like, and she's got black hair and green eyes. And so it was like, oh my God, you know, this, you know, I have a doppelganger 16 years younger. It was amazing, right? So I grow up, I end up in the same high school that she went to after getting thrown out of a handful of high schools. I ended up in public school. And guess who's the principal of our high school? Mr. Orsini. So every time I set something on fire or assaulted a fellow student or did something incredibly stupid and terrible, I ended up in his office and he would say, I remember the day you were born, your sister, she was such a beautiful girl and so intelligent. What is she? She's a nurse, Mr. Orsini. Did she do drugs? No, Mr. Orsini. Was she a good girl? Yes, Mr. Orsini. Are you like her? No. And he would tell me, lecture me this all the time. Why can't you be like your sister? I loved your sister, you know, blah, blah, blah. So fast forward, time for me to make an amends. So guess who now is the, you know, not, it wasn't the vice principal anymore, but is now like, you know, the principal is Mr. Orsini. So when I call up and I make an appointment, now I got to go sit in his office and I come in. And I come in with my letter, and I explain what I'm about, and I explain what I'm doing, and I offer my services, and I agree to meet with any of the faculty who's still there, who, you know, who was my, you know, my teacher at the time, and blah, 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 blah. And I said, what can I do to set this right? And he said, well, do you have your GED? He knew I dropped out, and he's like, do you have your GED? And I said, no. Really? He's like, well, you have any plans to go back to college? I'm like, no. I mean, because at this point, I after you get thrown out of 5 schools, you kind of stop going. You stop trying. I had created this whole thing that, like, I was dumb and that, like, I could never, like, do school, that I was, like, an idiot savant or something, you know, that I was really smart on my couch, but in the real world, like, I couldn't hack academia. So he was like, well, here's what you got to do to set it right. You have to go to college. He's like, you have to get your GED, you have to go to college. Shit. Because there's a thing, like, you know, when we're making amends and somebody tells us what we need to do, and it's a pretty reasonable thing, we really need to do it. He's like, I don't want your money. He's like, I don't want any of that. He's like, go donate that to a charity. He's like, I want you to go to college. So I had to go get my GED, so, you know, I do. I go to community college, and I graduate with a 4.0, and I thought, well, that's kind of the booby prize. When you graduate with a 4.0 from community college, you're like, Yeah, you know, state schools, you know, like university is going to be harder, so I graduate summa. You know, like a short list for valedictorian. You know, but that would never have happened if I didn't go make that amend. I would have remained afraid for the rest of my life. I would have been so afraid that I couldn't hack school, that I wasn't smart enough. You know, apparently it turns out if you drink a lot of NyQuil, Robitussin, and vodka and show up to class, you really don't absorb a whole lot of information. But like if you're not drinking and you're pretty clear-headed, you know, one, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, it's kind of simple. You know, but I didn't know that, and I wasn't willing to test that until I had to, when it became an obligation of my of the spiritual process that I was on, until it became a life or death errand. Because it tells me that I have to be willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcoholism. So when he gave me that, it was something I absolutely had to do. And the truth is I would never have done it for myself. But I was willing to do it to not die an alcoholic death. So that's, you know, an amends where it seemed like it was a very simple one, seemed like a really straightforward one, and it absolutely changed my life tremendously. And I'm a completely different person because of it. And it was really simple. Meeting with my principal and apologizing for setting shit on fire. You know? So I don't know what amend is going to be, the amend that changes everything about who I am. So I can't pick and choose the amends that I need to do. When it says all, it means all. No matter how hard or how petty, how strange they may be, all is all. There are some exceptions, but those are exceptions that you need to work out with your sponsor. And I want to explain something to you, and I'll finish this up. When it says to harm others, right? You are not others. I love it when people say, well, I would make amends to that person, but it would harm me. Really? Gee, you know, I'm absolutely sure that when you were totally screwing that person over, you know, and you were doing all these terrible things to them and, you know, making their life absolutely miserable, you know, what, you know, you were not thinking about this, you know, that it would, you know, how is this going to harm you? You know, I persecuted another human being. I made their life miserable, right? It's my job to clean it up, but it's going to make me feel bad, so I won't do it. Think about that for a minute. How selfish are we? We are not others. When they're talking about harming others, they're talking about our friends and family. We're talking about telling people things that maybe they don't need to know. You don't get to decide who gets to know. That is between you, your sponsor, and God. That's why it tells us to take it into meditation and prayer. It tells us to consult with others. You know, because my ego will say, well, I'm not going to admit to that because it might get me in trouble. Well, no shit. I should have thought of that before I did it. Now it's time to man up. Because this is about manning up and facing who we are and the things that we've done. Because there's no way we're going to feel, and it goes on and finishes, and I'll finish this up. Talks about being a child of God, that we stand on our feet, that we're not servile or scraping, recrawl before no one. The end result of this process is to experience that. So when we're talking about making these amends and facing these things, we're talking about doing that in terms of being a child of God and standing on our feet. We're not prostrating in front of people begging for forgiveness. We're acknowledging the harms that we have done, and we're doing our best to set them right. There's a different thing going on here. Anyway.
Something that I'm thinking about in the last few minutes is that a lot of times we did not see reality correctly. If you want to get to understand what I'm saying, you know, talk to some of your sisters and brothers about how you grew up. Mm-hmm. I've done that, and they saw a completely different household than I did. Going into my adulthood, going into my alcoholism, if you would have asked me how I grew up, I basically would have said I was pretty much abandoned. Nobody paid any attention to me. It seemed like everything was about my brothers and sisters. And, you know, I just seemed like a non-entity. And, you know, I can't remember my father ever spending any time with me. And you know, that would have been the story that I would have told you. But Recently, I've shown some interest kind of in our family history, and I've talked a lot to my brothers and sisters, and they saw something completely different. They saw me as the spoiled kid. They saw me as, I came 8 years after my brother and 12 years after my sister in this family. And they see that my father was doing a whole lot better in his job by the time I came along. So I was getting a lot better toys and a lot better stuff. And they were kind of resentful that, you know, I was getting all this stuff that they didn't have an opportunity to get. Well, the story I told myself in my head was that I didn't get what they got. Because there used to be this train room in our basement, gigantic room with the big Lionel trains. And I remember it being taken down just before I would have been old enough to play on it. So I was talking about this with my brother not long ago. I go, you know, well, what about the train room? And he goes, that was always broken. You know, I never got a chance to play on that. They finally just took it down. So I'm telling myself stories that aren't true. Now, I just came across a gigantic box of old family pictures. I'm like the family archivist now, you know? And my father died 3 days into my 12th birthday. And what had happened, I guess, you know, from age, you know, 12 on up, what had happened is I must have repressed some stuff because I didn't have a lot of memories of my father doing things with me. And if you would have asked me, you know, I would have said, well, you know, he was always busy and he didn't really spend a lot of time with me. Well, I'm going through this archive, this box of family pictures, and there's one picture after another with my father and me, just the two of us, at Blowing Rock, North Carolina, down at the shore at the boardwalk. You know, here, I mean, he used to grab me and drag me all over the place as a kid. And I'm finding the proof of this stuff in these pictures. A lot of times we tell ourselves bad stories, and we tell them long enough that they become our past. Yep. You go through this step work, and what will happen is you'll be open to the ability to change your story, the ability to change your past, like I have. You know, I'm not seeing things the way I saw them. For one reason or another, I made up a story that wasn't true. And we do this a lot of different ways. And, you know, when I went back and made amends to my father, I read the letter on the grave, you know, and you know, I buried it next to the tombstone. And from that moment forward, he's been working his way back into my life one way or another, whether I'm finding these pictures or, you know, my brother and sister are telling me stories. And, you know, that particular story is changing. Sometimes we just don't have the right perspective. Alcoholism has a lot to do with perspective and perception. We see things wrong so often. A lot of this step work clears away that stuff and allows us to view things as they really are, the truth. Get down to the truth about the causes and conditions of our problems. We don't want our problems to be our responsibility. We want everything to be somebody else's fault. We want to be the child who was ignored. We want to be, you know, the person who the boss went after unnecessarily. I mean, you know, we want the failure of our life to be placed somewhere besides right squarely at our feet. But the fact of the matter is, you know, our problems are of our own making. You know, we need to see this. We need to take responsibility for it. We need to make amends for where these character defects have caused harm. And we need to move forward with our lives. We need to do this to survive. A lot of people who are moral, you know, a moral people, and they do the right thing. You know, those idiots that always just seem to be doing the right thing, you know, making you look bad. Some people just know that, you know, you need to do this. You need to apologize when you've been wrong. You need to, you know, you need to pay money back when you owe it. Some people just know that out of a sense of being. We have to sometimes learn it the hard way. And sometimes we have to be faced with alcoholic devastation if we don't learn this stuff. Because there are people out there in the real world that can get away with some bad stuff. As an alcoholic, unfortunately, we don't have that option. We don't have that ability to be able to continue to rape, rob, and pillage, you know, across the universe. We can't stay sober doing that. Every once in a while, somebody shows up in AA who is rape, robbing, and pillaging, and they're staying sober. I can tell you right now, they're not alcoholics. There are people who come into our rooms to prey. You know, they're predators for money, for sex, for whatever. You know, they see us as a bunch of defective suckers sometimes, and they come in. Those are non-alcoholics. The people that can 13-step till the cows come home and just destroy, you know, 20 or 30 lives in their wake, those are not alcoholics. Because my book basically tells me if my conduct continues to harm others, I am quite sure to drink. And I have seen that experience. I've seen that happen to a number of people who I really was convinced were alcoholics, yet they wanted to continue to act in very, very selfish ways. They got drunk. Every once in a while, someone comes in and they're acting really selfish. You know, they're in the wrong room. Or maybe they're in the right room for them. You know, and sometimes we have to watch out for them. Bill, how much time we got? We got no time. All right. We're going to take a 15-minute break, folks.